I am John Cryer, and this is the Undisclosed Addendum. On this week's show, we'll be talking about episode 8 of our Dennis Perry arc, Reason Why, which sought to tease a motive for the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain out of a tangle of contradictory evidence. And with us today are Susan Simpson. She's an associate at the Volkov Law Group and also the host of the 45th podcast. Hello, Susan Simpson.
Hey, John.
And we have Colin Miller. He's an associate dean and professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he blogs at Evidence Prof Blog. I got it right the first time. Yay! Hey, Colin, how are you?
Great, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. I'm doing very well. Yet again, a terrific episode of Undisclosed, laying a lot of stuff out that I had been wondering for a while, like, for instance, why the police sort of glossed over the hate crime possibility of the murder of Harold and Thelma Swain awfully quickly. I mean, this was 1985. We were not completely, you know, it wasn't the civil rights era, so it wasn't about, you know, the Klan rampaging through the South. But there were very high profile hate crimes. It was still very much in the news. This was around the time of, you know, the Tawana Brawley case that happened in New York, which, you know, ended up the grand jury declared it a hoax, which, by the way, is weird. Grand juries aren't supposed to do that. But we'll get to that on another episode. But my point being, it was very much in the public eye. It does seem odd that the police, you know, immediately dismissed that possibility.
Yeah. Someone tweeted this morning. I was like, listening to Undisclosed, how is the Dylann Roof case just being brought up at episode 8? And I mean, it was literally my first thought when I heard the facts of the case. And it was just bizarre that there was almost no discussion of sort of racism or possible hate crime motivations. Like, what you've heard in the show so far is literally everything. I've taken out a few tiny bits of the case file that mention it to address them on the show, but those are buried in, like, thousands and thousands of other pages. For the most part, the question of race is just not in the case file whatsoever.
It seems like the authorities dismissed it because the Swains were so well-liked, as though anger, you know, personal anger motivated hate crimes like that. And it seems like, no, that the whole thing with hate crimes is that they're directed at a class of people, not, you know, a personal vendetta.
Yeah. And there is more to the story there we're going to get into. I was confused by lots of us seeing for a long time. But that's definitely racism, unsurprisingly, is part of the story. And which involves a young white man killing an elderly black couple, unsurprisingly. But it took a while to figure out even where it came in, because for the most part, everyone just denied that racism could possibly be a part of this case. I mean, the sheriff was outright saying from the start, this was not about race. This was about robbery or something else. And that carries through. You know, so one thing when I was talking to Christina about the first call I had with her, and she told me about the case, is, like, at trial, did the prosecutor try and, like, play this up? Like, were they trying to, like, get sympathy or, like, trying to make it seem like a race crime? And they really don't. That's never really an angle they try to push, even at trial, even though the motive theoretically is partially race-based.
Well, it was interesting because thank you guys so much for giving the context of how often church crimes happen, you know, where people attempt to rob churches. That was completely news to me. So I can see, you know, the original sort of bias that police would probably have and would completely understandably have would be to see this as a completely conventional crime, that the type of which they see around, which is somebody tried to rob a church, it went horribly wrong. And it sounds like that was their first impulse to a hammer. You know, every problem looks like a nail, you know. But it sounds like the first investigators did a fairly decent job of chasing down leads. That the hate crime part of it was so secondary, it really surprised me.
Yeah, yeah. And they did eventually send a request to the state-level agency for, like, check their databases. They could have all the, you know, KKK connections checked out. But that was not their first move, and it did take a while for that to happen. And, you know, I don't actually think they're wrong. After getting through everything in the case, I came to agree that it was likely not a race-based crime, at least not of the traditional sort here. But it was and still is weird to me that they got there so quickly to rule it out.
And the circumstances of the crime are such that, you know, they're so kind of amorphous, you know, they really do play into many possible scenarios. And actually, you guys did an admirable job of laying them all out. Although I have to say the robbery one that you went into great detail about did seem certainly the most plausible to me. But it was an interesting assumption you guys made about, and I can sort of see why it was, but that Thelma Swain was just, for all intents and purposes, an innocent bystander who was just caught in the crossfire. How did you guys arrive at that?
That was the assumption of people involved in the case, investigators, and pretty much everyone involved. And it does seem sort of, I still waffle on this one for various reasons, but I do think based on what we know, it doesn't seem like it was planned to kill Thelma. Or if it was planned to kill Thelma, it was chance how she was killed. Because there's no way the guy could have known that she had run out towards her husband. She might, sure. But it's possible that he was not even planning to kill Harold right there in the vestibule or God knows what. I've gone through in my head, like trying to think through all the possible ways this could have gone down. And it does not seem like whoever killed Harold could have known that they could have gotten Thelma as well.
Yes. And as I said, the sort of target of opportunity aspect of this, as you mentioned, that is because it's on a thoroughfare, you know, it's at Road 17, I believe.
US 17, yeah.
US 17. So, you know, it's not on a backwoods road that nobody ever travels on.
Well, it is, though, kind of. So US 17.
Oh, okay, so I'm wrong.
It used to be sort of the major road there. Then I-95 was built, and basically everything went to I-95 instead. So US 17 at that point became more of a backwoods road. Not bad. It's still like, you know, a major road, but it's not like the only road like it was back in the old days. And part of the, one of the theories is that because this is the first church you come to off of the I-95 exit, maybe that's why it was targeted. Like if you're driving on I-95 and you get off and take that exit, if you turn right, the first retail you'd see is the liquor store, really, the Reed store at the corner there. And if you keep going, the first church is Rising Daughter. And it's probably three or four churches right after that, but Rising Daughter is the first one. So that could suggest that someone's just driving by and stops the first place they can. Maybe they checked out Rising Daughter or checked out the Reed store and decided that it was not a good place to hit, kept going. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, it could be any number of reasons. I was thinking, why would somebody not hit a liquor store and hit a church instead? But you would figure a liquor store is probably a little more prepared for a robbery than a church.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
probably
they had a gun there.
They had a gun there. Well, there you go.
She was when he walked in, she said that she felt nervous for some. I say him, assuming it's the same guy that did the murders. We don't know that. But if it was the same guy that did the murders, for whatever reason, when he came in, she, Leona Reed, who worked at the store there, felt like he might rob her. So he may have picked up on her readiness or her anxiety, thought that she's way too prepared for this and didn't carry it out.
She already had her antenna up. I'm sure you would have mentioned if there was video surveillance at the store.
No.
You know, I was just hopeful. Come on. Let me have that.
That would be nice.
You don't even get that in cases where you'd expect to have it, so let alone have it here.
Mm-hmm. But again, she was clearly on the ball. She noted the person. She was able to remember it in some detail later because of the way that he paid. And I'm still surprised that the police didn't put more store in her witness testimony.
Well, I think they did. I mean, it seems like they used her identification for like a major description they're putting out. It was later on when Dennis is the suspect, they don't really consider her useful.
Right. It seems that comes later because her accounting doesn't really help them in the case against Dennis. Whereas when they're in the investigatory phase, yeah, it makes sense to rely on her more.
But as I said, they didn't have her do a composite. And it seems like she had an interaction where she would have had a really a memorable situation with the person's face.
That is strange to me. I don't have any answers there.
Yeah, I can't.
Unless they did and they lost it.
Right.
We could have had another version of Kurt Cobain. sorry, that's a callback to like three addendums ago. So forgive me. But also, unfortunately, the facts of the crime really lend themselves to multiple interpretations. As you pointed out, he didn't wear a mask. That could be any number of things. It could have been that it was a crime of opportunity. It could have been that it was a crime of anger specifically intended at the Swains. It could be interpreted so many ways.
No, I swear, it really felt at times it felt like it was scripted to be this way. Like if you wanted to write a script of a murder that could be anything and it was open about every possibility on the table still, I mean, this is a pretty good attempt at that.
Yeah, and they didn't even, if it was a target of opportunity, how come they didn't take anything? How come they didn't take any money?
But there are a lot of crimes like that where you have someone going in for robbery and the murder happens and the person is not planning committing murders. And I guess some people might accidentally commit a murder and be like, okay, I'm still going to rob. Whereas some are like, well, let's just call it a loss and get out of here now. So I mean, there was no money in plain sight. There was money in his pocket. There were pocketbooks in the sanctuary of the church. But, I mean, this guy left his glasses behind, so clearly he was not searching that well.
We'll never agree on everything, but I think we can agree we could all use more sleep. Getting a great night's sleep is easier and more affordable than you think. You don't need a new expensive mattress or sleeping pills. You just need to change your sheets. That's why you should check out Boll & Branch. Everything Boll & Branch makes, from bedding to blankets, is made from pure, 100% organic cotton, which means they start out super soft and they get even softer over time. You buy directly from them, so you're essentially paying wholesale prices. Luxury sheets can cost up to $1,000 in the store, but Boll & Branch sheets are only a couple hundred bucks. Everyone who tries Boll & Branch sheets loves them. That's why they have thousands of five-star reviews. And Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, and Fast Company are all talking about Boll & Branch. Even three U.S. presidents sleep on Boll & Branch sheets. Now, I've had Boll & Branch sheets for over a year, and they're great. They're soft, they're cool, and they always help me get a good night's sleep. And now you can try them risk-free. Shipping is free, and you can try them for 30 nights. If you don't love them, send them back for a refund. But I doubt you want to send them back, because there's no risk and no reason not to give them a try. To get you started, right now, Undisclosed listeners, you can get $50 off your first set of sheets at bollandbranch.com, promo code undisclosed. Go to bollandbranch.com today for $50 off your first set of sheets. That's B-O-L-L and branch.com, promo code undisclosed. Bollandbranch.com, promo code undisclosed.
Oh, another strange thing that you brought up actually a couple episodes ago was the parishioners were very frightened that the killer was still there. And you sort of got the impression that they had reason to feel that way. You know, what were the parts of that that it made no sense? Why would the killer stick around in that situation?
And this is a kind of a frustrating part from the original investigation, because they do not document this at all. And I wish they had, and they don't remember now. But Margie Moore in her interview, and I think it's Letty Frazier, talk about how they... So they're probably 15 minutes between the shooting and the time Margie runs for help. And at one point earlier, Margie and Letty try to make a run for it, and they see something. And it causes them to think the killer's still there, so they run back inside. And they never get them to define exactly what they saw. They're just like, oh, we saw – she says like them. Oh, we saw them out there, or we saw them somewhere. And we saw them still moving around, so we came back. One possibility is that actually, because the woman did split up a bit, it could be they heard or saw the other group of women, and that just freaked them out and they ran back. But It's never really clarified in the transcripts we have, and I still don't know what to make of it. But there's also the fact that the car, Margie Moore thinks she saw a car that was not belonging to one of the people in the church that night that was out there when she left.
And this is by no means a criticism, by the way, because if I was in that situation, I would be terrified. And I too would sort of shelter in place and, you know, wait till the police came. I wouldn't be the first one to run through the vestibule, especially if I knew people had been shot right there. You know, it would be terrifying. Did any of them try to go out and see if Harold and Thelma could be, given some sort of medical attention?
No, not from what I can put it together. They went out. So there's basically... a little door in the side of the church that connects to the kitchen, I believe. And that's how Margie Moore ran out. That's where they all escaped from. So they did not go through the vestibule. But they didn't really know what had happened. Some of them saw Thelma get shot, and they were presuming that Harold got shot, but they didn't actually know what was going on out there. And that's why Margie Moore finally ran for help. She's like, we got to get them help. We got to get the medical treatment. They're going to be saved, not knowing they couldn't be. I mean, it seems like it was mostly just confusion. You have women running every which way. It's not a big church, but there's like three back rooms. Some of the women were hiding on the toilets, standing on the toilets, thinking maybe the killer came in. He'd like look under the stall and not see their feet or something. So it's hard to tell if that was really the killer that spooked them or if it was just other ladies. And if it was the killer still there, then I am so confused because I have no idea how to explain that whatsoever.
Well, we've never heard any kind of explanation as to how the killer got away.
Drove off, it seemed. Well, depends on.
Well, that was the thing. If he had to take a motorcycle ride just to get there, did he walk to the church from where he got the motorcycle ride? Was he dropped off with, you know, an accomplice? Did the accomplice drive off with him? Or was he in one of the cars that supposedly was weaving from side to side, you know, that was spotted by a witness? You know, the police never get into how he got away.
Or did they in the trial?
And they do.
Oh, they do in the trial?
They do.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, then I'm looking forward to that.
In a way.
Oh, great. Well, I'm sure it'll be creative. We can be grateful for that. Also, it was unclear because, you know, we've heard so many chunks of Dale Bundy's interrogation interviews. And occasionally, you know, I would listen to it and go, oh, wait a minute. He thinks there's an accomplice. Oh, wait, he thinks there's a reason for this. But it's difficult to tell what Dale Bundy actually thought went down because, you know, obviously he's not the prosecutor and he might be lying to the people he's doing these interviews with, or he's speaking from, you know, incomplete information at that time. Did you ever get a sense of what he actually believes?
So I've wondered a lot about this. I think in those interviews that you hear, I don't think you could take what he's saying there to be his literal beliefs. What he does is like literally textbook retechnique. And everything he says should be understood through that lens. Like he's like, there's like 9 steps to it typically, and he's following them. Boom, 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 boom. And so when he's making up the story, like, oh, maybe it was kind of something like self-defense, I think that's what that really should be understood as. At the same time, from talking to Dale Bundy, it does seem like my suspicion, and this is purely speculation, this is just an impression I have, not saying Dale Bundy said it all, so I don't want to attribute this to him. This is just my speculation, really, from talking to him. He does have a theory. But he doesn't think it's like one worth sharing because it's probably not supported by like any overt evidence. So he's happy to leave it as what it is. But I think he probably has his own theory about what happened here. And my suspicion is that it has something to do with the transaction because he uses that word a lot. And I'm trying to think, like, why do you keep saying that someone went there for a transaction that night? What transaction could it have been? There's no evidence that anyone went there for a transaction, really, that I know of. But I think something along those lines is what he believes may have actually happened here.
Perhaps it seemed like the marijuana stories were sort of floating around. Do you think he's like sort of trying to hint that there was some sort of drug-based transaction going on there?
Yeah, I do think that's a belief that's going on here because there's, of course, the first Dale Bundy memo, the one that we have that he wrote in November of 1998, that says in July of 98, Jane Beaver told him that Dennis Perry told her that Harold Swain had a lot of money because he was dealing drugs at the Rawls store. I mean, that's not a type, but let's be real. Like, that was something that he wrote down deliberately, and presumably Jane Beaver told him, because Jane Beaver also hints at that in her own hearing testimony. Like, I think she said that Dennis Perry told her that it was more than he could afford, and he knew how he afforded it, which I think was a covert way of referring to drug dealing.
When I see the word transaction, Susan, not about you, but I think one of two things. One is sort of like two sophisticated corporations or businesses doing some type of business venture or drug dealing. Like those are the two words. The two situations that jump to mind. There's not really.
It's binary.
Right. Painting my house is not a transaction. Buying a car, like selling drugs or a sophisticated business deal is a transaction.
It's straight up cop speak. Like, we proceeded to the vehicle for the transaction. Like, that's how they write when they're talking about drugs.
Yeah, and which does bring us to the Jane Beaver of it all, which is, you know, that her story has a lot of, well, holes. And in the end, was it corroborated by anybody?
No.
Carol Ann, was she ever asked to testify?
She did testify at trial, and she mostly said that she didn't know anything. She said that when she was interviewed by Dale Bundy, she didn't like it because he kept trying to put words in her mouth and kept trying to suggest that she knew something when she didn't know anything, is how she put it, I think. There is one part of the story that she can independently corroborate, but it's nothing to do with any of the relevant bits. She thinks Dennis it's a long story, I'll get into it later, but she thinks that Dennis did once have a pair of women's glasses for some reason, because she can recall her mom making fun of him for it. But that's the only part she verifies. Everything else, she didn't hear.
And Jane, Ms. Beaver, parts of her story don't make sense to me. Like, was she just sitting in her house waiting for the police to come by so she could say, thank goodness you've come, as Dale Bundy relayed? No, she was showing around pictures to people. It seems odd that she would do that investigative work, but then not contact the police herself. Or did she? And it just wasn't in that particular episode.
There is not a single document left that suggests Jane Beaver. Like, there's nothing until that day that Bundy goes to her trailer. There is not a single reference to Jane Beaver anywhere in the files. I don't know why that is, because according to Jane Beaver, she called all the damn time. And according to at least one officer, actually, she did call all the damn time. So it does seem like she may have tried to be in contact, or may have reported, like, done stuff. She may have called in information. But for some reason, all records of this were lost, which is only, I think, most interesting to me because she claims she called after Unsolved Mysteries. And those are computer printouts from the Unsolved Mysteries books. So, like, if it, that'd be kind of the one place I'd expect her tip to have not gotten purged from if it existed. And it's not in there. There is no record of her calling in Unsolved Mysteries.
Speaking of records, Detective Bundy mentioned at one point that he didn't know when the lines were cut. And that kind of threw me off. I was like, oh gosh, see, now that you mention it, there's no proof that the lines were cut that night. It could have, you know, somehow happened at a different time. It seems unlikely that a functioning church on a Monday that, you know, I'm sure had business that they were doing on a Sunday wouldn't have noticed that the phone rang or the phone wasn't ringing, as it were.
Yeah, well, so these are like small country churches. They are not in use all that often. One part of the story that's interesting to me is that I know from the, talking to the people in the area who went to that church is that they only held services of Rising Daughter once a month, we think, in this area. They rotated between churches, and not every church had a service every Sunday. So I don't even think they had a service the day before the killings happened. But I'm not certain of that because it's obviously there's no perfect records. We're going on memories here many years on. But if there was a service, I mean, it's possible they didn't notice the phone was cut. But then we get to the question of who the hell would cut the phone line to Rising Daughter without committing a crime there. We do know that Butch Kennedy, the deputy that was first in the case, did talk to Bell South and did check with them and verify that there was no complaints or no suggestion from anyone in the past, I think, 4 months that Rising Daughter's phones were not working.
Do they have records of phone calls, perhaps, in the days leading up to it? No.
Of course, we have the individual who visited the church a week before the shooting, and so maybe at that time that could be a possibility for when they were cut.
That's true, and we don't know who that guy was. I mean, I have to believe that Butch Kennedy got an answer there because he did talk to the pastor that this unknown blonde man went and talked to. But those transcripts are not there. We don't have the audio tape. And there's no way to know now if it really was verified that that was unrelated.
And well, again, this to me, this new information that you're giving me that the church was not used particularly often, again, makes it seem like intentionally targeting the Swains doesn't make any sense, that they didn't normally have those meetings. He wasn't normally in attendance at those meetings. It just seems like if you were intentionally going to target the Swains, go to their house. You know, supposedly Dennis Perry knew, you know, we had a listener question, actually. Did Dennis's grandparents live right next door to the Swains?
No, they were not next door. I'm going to guess here. It's probably not a mile. It's probably like half a mile. But basically, there's a stretch of road between US 17 and I-95 called Dover Bluff. And all these players are living on either on Dover Bluff itself or little side roads next to it, for the most part. The community is called Spring Bluff. I don't know if you'd call it a town or what, but like it's a area of Waverly called Spring Bluff. And this little sort of cross section of Dover Bluff area. So you've got a bunch of houses kind of clustered closer to US 17. That's where Dennis's grandparents lived, near the Reed store. That's where Carol Ann Buzz, his girlfriend, lived. And then you have a few more houses that dotted up towards I-95, and that's closer to where the Swains were.
And did Jane Beaver live there as well?
She did in 87 when she moved in. So she lived in Brunswick, which is the sort of the biggest city that's close by at all, until 87 when she moved closer to her daughter and her father over in Spring Bluff. So from 87 onwards, she was there. But at the time of the murder, she was not.
And so much of her story just seems odd to me. Is, you know, why it sounds a lot like the jailhouse informants who's, you know, when for some reason people find a reason to bring up the crimes they intend to commit or have committed. That always bumps me, I have to say.
There's sometimes witnesses have a way of describing events that sounds like it's out of a movie. And it's hard to know if you're being unfair and judging that way or if it's because it does sound like it's out of a movie. But the way this whole exchange goes down, I mean, Colin, what did you think about it when you first saw Jane Beaver's testimony?
Yeah, I mean, it just, it's one of those, I think she kind of had a vendetta against him and was going to do what she could to ensure he was convicted. And it definitely struck me as questionable, the story that she was telling. And that's kind of why I wish we knew whether she had made these prior calls, but I also wish if she did, we had a record to compare them because I would have a thought process that she had changed this story over time.
Spoilers, but I'll say that from the traces of memory we have, people who think she did call before, the story they remember her calling in about didn't match the trial testimony.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
But
yeah.
Again, we're talking many years on and there's right. No written record. So could that be why there's no written record?
Well, it occurs to me what an incredible advantage it is to the prosecution to have a detective who does not take contemporaneous notes. because just in the way you guys were presenting the episode, every time that you said something that came from a report of Dale Bundy's, you said, well, it's possible that he didn't remember it exactly correctly, or it's possible that she said this, but it said it in different words, or, you know, and you end up having to give so much of the benefit of the doubt in that case, because you don't want to say, I don't want to say a police officer is lying willfully. I don't want to say this witness is lying willfully. You know, my default is to they're probably being honest, you know, but it's an enormous help.
Yeah. You cannot impeach a witness this way because there's too much they can just like kind of get fuzzy on. Like the fact that supposedly this witness said that it was a drug deal that caused Dennis to do this, that's huge. And you got no mileage out of this at trial because at trial, she doesn't mention it. And they try and ask the detective. And he's like, I have no idea why it says that. And you can't figure out what really did happen. So you can't call Bundy a liar. You can't call Jane Beaver a liar. So this problematic fact that comes from like a few stray lines he bothered to record disappears. Like there's a reason Bundy doesn't record. Like Bundy knows what he's doing. Bundy knows that recording stuff gets you in trouble. So he doesn't record.
I do about 90% of my shopping online because it just makes my life easier, and most of the time it's the stuff I need. But once in a while you get something, a package that you have been looking forward to, and that is so much fun to unwrap. And believe me guys, I totally understood what the allure is of the unboxing videos when I got my first FabFitFun box. I was so excited, and actually my daughters gathered around, we were all pretty excited. We opened it up, it was a big old box, and inside the box, it's like Christmas, all these beautifully packaged full-size beauty and wellness products. Now, I am a complete sucker for beauty products. I love getting beauty products, but you know, sometimes you buy a product and you kind of are like, you don't really like it, can't commit to it, but you've spent a whole bunch of money. So with the FabFitFun box, what happens is for a fraction of the cost of the actual products, you get an entire array of products. And I want to tell you about my favorite product from this first box. It's called the Spongel Infused Loofah. It is amazing. It's this gorgeous little flower-shaped loofah that has some kind of heavenly smelling infused cleanser in it. I have been using it every day for the last few weeks. It still has not run out. I have forbidden anybody else from touching it. I love that thing. I've never even known that that product existed. Along with that, I got a bunch of other amazing beauty products. I did have to give some up to my daughters, but fine, fair enough. So here's how FabFitFun works. What happens is 4 times a year, they will deliver a box to you for $49.99 a box, $49.99 a box. You get a big old box that has full-size fashion, beauty, home, fitness, and wellness products. And this box retails. I mean, like if you were to buy everything by itself, you're talking about hundreds of dollars. A single product in that box can cover the cost of the entire box. Now, the reason I want you to pay attention is because right now, FabFitFun has their fall box on pre-sale. These boxes sell out. The boxes start shipping August 20th, and you need to reserve this highly anticipated box today because, like I said, they actually sell out. You will get, once again, full-size products. There's no samples of everything. And every single box includes a couple of the following things. Number one, either a Glam Glow Bubble Sheet Mask package, or you get a beauty blender, which I love these beauty blenders. They've got a bunch of different shades. And every single member can choose between the Vince Camuto Luck Tote in Black or Red Desert, which retails for $128, or a beautiful crown brush, 6-piece brush set in silver or black, which by the way, retails for $75. Plus FabFitFun members have members only sales. So on top of getting these great products for incredible values, you actually would get access to exclusive sales from all of the amazing brands that FabFitFun partners with, and you get great deals, up to 70% off, and nobody else will get those deals, only you if you subscribe to this box. So sign up for FabFitFun today to get your fall box. The FabFitFun Fall Box is in limited supply, folks. They always sell out. So use our code UNDISCLOSED to get $10 off your first box. That would make it $39.99. $39 for this amazing box. Go to FabFitFun.com to sign up and start getting the box for a life well lived. Once again, use our promo code UNDISCLOSED to get $10 off your first box. That's nearly $300 worth of products for only $39.99. FabFitFun.com and use our code UNDISCLOSED.
Okay, at one point, Jane Beaver asserted that Dennis Perry's grandfather knew the African-American gentleman who Dennis Perry was approaching for money. Did she ever buttress that allegation?
No, she didn't. And it's interesting to me that Jane Beaver's story is that Dennis never actually named this man. From context, it sounds like it's got to be Harold Swain. I mean, the gray block house that she describes does fit him. I think that kind of rules out anyone else. But part of me kind of wonders if that's like fitting what was said at the church. We know that the killer never named the man. He just said, I want to talk to him. So I don't know if that could be suggesting that maybe Dennis didn't know his name, so he couldn't even tell it to Jane Beaver, or if he really didn't know his name, and that's how he was referring to him. But the other odd part of the story is the claim that Harold Swain and Dennis's grandfather, Zeke Wilson, were friends. I don't think that's true. They knew each other. They knew of each other. I'm sure they were friendly. I don't think they were friends. The most plausible scenario for how Dennis and Harold could have come into contact is that his grandmother, Susie, fished a lot all the time near a little river there. So she'd catch fish and sell them from her house. And at least one of the ladies at the church, Fandora Baker, told me that she did go to the Wilsons' house on occasion to buy fish directly from them. She did not remember Dennis. She didn't know if she knew Dennis had lived there, but she did go to that house sometimes to buy fish. So theoretically, it is possible that Harold Swain wanted to buy fish one day and went to the house, and that's how he would have seen Dennis Perry. So it could have happened. It's not implausible that happened. There's just no other evidence whatsoever that actually did happen.
Did the defense go to town on Jane Beaver's story just because there's no way to corroborate it? Did they even try?
They tried. They were, well, I'll get into it more. They were blocked partially by the judge, and they were also just didn't get very far with it. Their first witness they had on the stand for the defense was Vanzolda Williams, and they asked her one question. Was Harold Swain a drug dealer? And she said no, and that's it. So that's how they impeached her story, is having someone who knew Harold confirm that he was not a drug dealer. But since no one's even sure that that's really what she said to Bundy, I don't think they got really much mileage out of it.
Well, yeah, if I was a jury member, I would say, well, she didn't buy drugs from him. You know, who knows? I mean, I'm in no way meaning that to say, I mean, it doesn't sound, still doesn't sound plausible to me, but that seems, you know, very, I won't say half-hearted, but just ineffective at that time.
And they could have used Carol Ann more, I think. Carol Ann was not an unfriendly witness. She's not helpful necessarily, but they could have used her more, I think. The timing, she kind of defeats her mother's story, because her mother's story does not match timing we know of in terms of when they were dating, when they were visiting, when they would have gone to Brunswick together. I think they could have used that to show the basic premise of her story doesn't really make sense. Because even though they have 3 dates to go with, like a week, 3 weeks, or 6 weeks, which covers a lot of time, makes it harder to rule out stuff, none of those dates really fit with the timing we know of in terms of where Dennis was and how Dennis could have gotten to Camden County. And they don't make an issue of that. So they were in a hard spot. I'm not going to say that they dropped every ball, but they didn't have as much to work with as you'd think.
Yeah, it's tough to go too hard after her because, you know, that could make you look bad in the eyes of the jurors to really just go on a full-on attack. I think Susan's right that to have Carol Ann come in and testify and have an impeachment in that way where it's not overtly calling her out, it's just sort of showing these inconsistencies might have been more effective.
I honestly think they may have had the worst of all worlds here. From what I've seen, I think they may have actually gone too hard on Jane Beaver to the point where it kind of put off the jury, but not hard enough to make it worth
right.
it.
I wanted to circle back to the investigation and just police investigations in general. You guys suggest a kind of troubling idea, the idea being that even though the circumstances seem to suggest a transient, somebody that would be nearly impossible to catch in this situation, that the police might have gone for Dennis or for, you know, a more local suspect simply because that was a possible way to solve it or to have somebody see a consequence to that. That's a very troubling idea.
It's just an idea, and for all I know, it's probably projection because no one's ever explicitly said that, but and obviously, at least the original investigators were open to the idea this was a robbery. They were very open to it. You can hear on that Unsolved Mysteries clip that Joe Gregory, the GBI agent, was saying, my first hunch was probably right. It's a robbery. So they were definitely open to it. But it's kind of like the temptation in the case file over the years. Like every time they start looking into that, they kind of swerve back to possible, like all these possible permutations of how someone who knew the Swains could have done this. And I think I kind of, just from my own feelings, I get that appeal because at least you have a chance of solving it if it is someone who knew them. So, like, there's sort of a bias there to like keep going back to that, because there's only so much you can do to look into the theory that was a robbery. Like, you just so much. Once you cut off your leads, once you like tick them off, where are you going to go with that? How are you going to chase that down?
Well, you could be in a Golden State Killer situation where you've got a transient killer who's doing these awful crimes all over the place, but you can't. It's going to take decades.
And Butch Kennedy was all over that. I will say, like, this guy was like a very, very diligent deputy. You can see his letters and like his like records of who he like wrote to. This guy was writing to law enforcement all over the, like, anytime he saw a crime that was even a tiny bit similar, he's writing to them like, here is our like composite image and like description of the crime we had in Camden County. If you think this matches like your crime, please write back to me. So he was doing that. He was trying, and there were plenty of crimes that were deemed sort of similar that it looked into, but. As they say, when you get suspects that way, like, the odds are good, but the goods are odd. There's plenty to choose from, but they're not great suspects.
Well, I wanted to get to some listener questions. We got one from Patty Dan, who says, this may be a question for the addendum, but given that so many juries in these wrongful conviction cases that are so circumstantial get it wrong, do you think more defendants should request trial by judge instead of a jury?
This is always going to be a case-by-case thing. It always will be. But no.
Colin, do you have feelings about that?
Statistically, studies have shown that the rates of conviction are roughly similar, but that actually the conviction rate is slightly higher for judges. Now, that's not necessarily similar situations because it's different defendants who choose bench trials, but I think overall the effect is not significant, that it's the wrongful conviction rate is probably similar for bench trials versus jury trials.
Yeah, there are times, obviously, where you'd want to go with one or the other, but it, to me, when people make a call for the bench trial, it always seems like the wrong reasons and they backfire.
Well, what would call for a bench trial as opposed to a jury trial?
The typical scenario is something that you think that the jury can't look past, but an impartial judge might, like some kind of bad, like, care, I don't know, like something that like looks kind of icky or nasty or you think might turn the jury off. And it seems like the idea that the judge can be less turned off by that doesn't really pan out most of the time. Or they have a case where they think it's going to be like too complicated for the jury. Honestly, it can be too complicated for the judges too, if it's not the case. Like, that, if that's your problem, then simplify your case. Don't try and play up to the judge. But, you know, hindsight's 20/20. If you lose for a judge, you're always like, well, I should have gone to the jury.
We got another question from Steven Sunday, who says, I find the racism and borrowing money motives to be contradictory. If one is racist, they would not put themselves in a situation where they may appear weaker than the opposing race. Furthermore, the act of asking for money alone would be embarrassing.
See, that I would agree before this case, but among the many, many, many suspects in this case, and there are very many, there are a couple of them, like probably I think three I can think of right now, who were reported because they were people who were, one, racist, and two, had a habit of going to churches to ask for handouts and often would seek out black churches to borrow from. So that seems contradictory, but actually it seems more predatory in my mind. From after reading these reports or tips about these people, they are going, and I guess in one sense, they're going to beg from people they consider inferior or that they don't like or think are, you know, somehow, I guess, like genetically less than them or something like that. But it's not, in their view, I don't think they see it that way. In their view, they see it as like grifting people they don't like. Or they're taking advantage of someone who deserves to be taken advantage of.
Or I think there's a great deal of embarrassment in asking for money, and you're basically asking outside of your community. You know, somebody told me, and I wish I could cite the statistic on this, but that poverty isn't necessarily the biggest driver of crime, that there are poor societies, but that they have very low mobility. And in poorer societies where, you know, poverty may be more entrenched, but a sense of community is there because you don't travel nearly as much. You don't come into contact with lots of people you don't know, that crimes happen a lot less because there's a social aspect to crime, that somebody might be willing to just pop into a church, you know, that they don't frequent or they know nobody would be at it. You know, if a white supremacist has a pretty good bet that the black church in town is not going to, you know, they're not going to know him. It seems contradictory, but I get it. The scenario that you guys lay out for, you know, the robbery gone wrong scenario, that's the one that coalesces the most possible bits that are still unexplained for me.
But I don't want it to be true either, because I don't. If that's true, I don't know if we can ever solve this case.
Yes,
so I'm going to fall for the same trap. That's what happened here. Is that I want to, I mean, I don't know. I agree. That's why I keep circling back towards the robbery theory. It does answer the most box. It doesn't answer everything, but it does seem to explain better than yes. anything else.
Human beings are addicted to narrative. We need things to be stories and to have certain things come out in a sequential order that makes some sense. But that's not life necessarily.
This crime, you want it to make sense. You want it to not, like, everything about it's so awful and like haunting, and like for the Swains to be killed like that, you kind of, it's not to be better if someone like intended to kill them, but it'd give you a way to understand it, I guess. Just, it'd be less like just randomly and awful like this if it was just some random person passing through.
So we got another one from Corey Colorist, who says, dark on top, blonde tips could explain the different description from witnesses.
It could. That description there of darker up top, lighter on bottom comes only from Leona, the woman who worked at the Reed store. And we do know the hairs they found in the glasses, one was blonder, one was browner, and they came from the same person. So this person did have brown and blonde hairs. Although, if you are a hairstylist, I would love to hear what you think about razor cut and what that means, because I don't know how much I trust the forensic scientist that was looking at this, but they said that they thought the hairs had been razor cut. I don't know. Was that a style in the 80s? I don't know.
I don't. Yeah, I think Corey Colorist, you got to chime in on this. Help us out here.
We need hairstylists to come in, let us know like what razor cut, like what Southern guys wanted to wear back then.
Yes, I had some famous 80s hairstyles. I came close to the flock of seagulls at one point. but sadly, sadly, I'm not actually a hairstylist. I just sported some spectacular ones.
The best part of watching like old true crime stuff, like on like the ID channel from like the 80s when they have, you know, their older episodes, is that the hairstyles all the officers are wearing.
Priceless, like, priceless.
That much volume and feathering. How'd they even do that?
It was a lot of petroleum, I believe, was involved. We were heavily dependent on Saudi Arabia at the time, with good reason. We got another one. This is from Jenny, who's been a longtime listener, actually. And she says, another great addendum this week. I insist on reading that, even though I didn't have to. Unfortunately, no mentions about DNA results. Did I miss something, or does it mean that results don't exist? Sorry, just curious about it. And I think she was referring to the Pepsi cans that were found. They were bottles?
Well, it's kind of, I think they're probably bottles. It's not really clear. But they're gone. That's why we don't know, because they're missing.
So no is the answer to that.
They could be somewhere and have DNA on them, but until we find them, which we so far have had no luck doing, there's no way to test it. But they would presumably, if they were stored right, who knows? But I mean, Harold Swain's hands were bagged. Like, if we could find that, if we could find anything that they samples from there, possibly, maybe DNA from that as well. But otherwise, no DNA, only DNA so far is from the glasses.
And we also got a question from @supersetters. And it says, with respect to the ATF employee testimony, feds are subject to Toohey, which is Toohey v. Reagan, restrictions. HTH and enjoy the weekend. What is HTH?
I don't know what that means.
I don't know.
Hit that hottie. No. I don't know what HTH.
Hi, thanks. How?
I don't know, but I will enjoy the weekend. Certainly.
Right, I need to know.
What is HTH? But this refers to Ron Rhodes has been. I hope this helps. Thank you. Thank you, Supersetter. And we'll see if it helps in a moment when Susan answers the question. But this is referring to that Ron Rhodes, who is now employed by the ATF, did not feel that he could respond to us without their permission, which we were wondering, why would that be necessary if this wasn't a case that had anything to do with the ATF? But according to TUI, apparently, there's a reason for that. Is that correct?
So TUI restrictions have to do with like litigation. They would not apply here. I guess there's an interesting question if they could possibly apply in the context of a state case that needs evidence from a now federal employee who was a state employee at the time this happened. So there could, I don't think it would apply, but I guess there could be kind of a hypo there. But no, in this context, no, for a reporter asking a question, that would not be a restriction. I still don't know why Ron Rhodes wouldn't talk. It could be that the ATF won't let any of their employees talk about anything in their lives, but I just don't know.
Well, that's it for our listener questions, and that's all the questions I've got. Thank you, Susan. Was there anything you wanted to add about this week's episode?
No, just that, wait, so John, you were around in the 80s.
Yes. I was notably around.
When you heard about the, like, the wires being cut, mm-hmm. what did you think? Was that, like, familiar? Like, is that a thing you recall happening?
Well, yeah, there because there was famous cases with that. There was the Manson family.
Big ones. But, like, day-to-day stuff, was that a thing? Because, like, to me, I never really heard of, like, day-to-day crimes doing it until I started looking into it. And I was shocked to see that, like, honestly, it really kind of was what you did as a criminal back then.
Yeah, at the time, it was a clear indication of malevolent intent. It was, I'm going to attack all these people in this house and kill them slowly, and I don't want anybody to be able to call the police. It definitely had a very, very dark inference.
But even then, it seemed pretty sinister, not like a casual, yes. I'm going to rob this joint, let's like cut the wires first.
No, it was not considered just something that robbers would do to be practical. You know, like,
so, like, there are a ton of, I mean, I cited a few in the show, but I have like a file of like all the ones from like, I think 83 to like 87 in like Florida, Georgia, Alabama, South Carolina. And there's a lot of them. So apparently even the dumb criminals figured it out, except they often didn't know how to cut the wires right.
Uh-huh. Well, I grew up in an urban area and you wouldn't know where to do that. I mean, you'd have to go into the basement of apartment buildings to find the phone exchange. So
that's probably why it's more rural crimes this happens. I didn't think about that.
Yeah. Because, yeah, in rural areas, you can see that. You can see the telephone pole and it's a wire that goes right to the house and there's a box there. And it's, you know, it's super easy and accessible with good reason because that's what they, you know, when they want to fix it, they want to be able to get to it.
So, I did love the stories, though, where they cut the wrong one. Yes. And then go into a crime and someone like picks the phone up like, wait, how'd you do that?
You're magical. Well, yeah, again, your scenario of somebody casing the joint and making that decision to do that then makes total sense to me. You know, there's people there, you know, okay, the way this is going to go down, I have a gun. I'm going to, you know, find, you know, whoever is the biggest cheese in the room, neutralize them by just letting them know there's a robbery happening and then I'll shake down everybody. It's the way people do bank robberies. It's the way they, you know, that still seems the most plausible to me. But, you know, who knows? I mean, maybe it's a criminal genius who was, you know, stalking them and just happened to know Harold Swain would be there that night or followed him there. I mean,
Well, next week you may hear a theory about that.
Okay. Okay. Well, I will be grateful to hear that and I will be listening next week. Thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you, John. And see you next week. Or yes. Will I?
No, you know what? I won't be. I can't do the addendum next week, but I'll be back the week after.
All righty.
Okay. Thanks, Susan. And that's another addendum. I just want to remind everybody, Undisclosed does now have a Patreon. It is at patreon.com/undisclosedpod, and you can sign up there to help Undisclosed do the important work that it does. You also get the bonus episodes, which are Rabia and Colin and Susan just hanging out, talking about cases that they're interested in, which, honestly, is worth the price of admission alone. So please, if you feel like checking out our website, it's undisclosed-podcast.com. There's a list of all the criminal justice-related charities that you can make a donation to. As I said, I'm donating all of my fees for this season to the Georgia Innocence Project. You can find the Georgia Innocence Project at georgiainnocenceproject.org. That's fairly obvious, but you never know. And you can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle @UndisclosedPod and send any questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. I'm going to thank my assistant, Andrew Congdon, as well as Hannah McCarthy, who just does a wonderful, wonderful editing job on this. You must understand what comes out of my mouth is all sorts of spaghetti. And Hannah edits it together, and it sounds beautiful at the end of the day. I want to thank Patrick Cortez, who composed our addenda theme, and Meethal Telhan, our project manager, who keeps the trains running on time. Thank you, Meethal. And thank you all so much. I won't be here for next week's addendum. That will be hosted by somebody else. But we will have many addendums after that, addenda after that. And I will be here for those. So I'm very much looking forward. And thank you so much for listening.